Into sports.
20 yards out, Urs to shoot. Don't shoot! Oh, what a goal for Fabinho! Wow!
Then get into the all-new OTB Sports app.
I think when he apologises to me, I probably will say hello to him, yeah.
No. Videos, sports news, live scores, interviews.
If Fabregas is going to come up to me in the street and give me some of the mouth that he would have given me on a football pitch, what would he do? He'd get a slap.
Plus, exclusive content on the OTB Podcast Network. The biggest names in sports, ready when you are. Search OTB Sports on your App Store and download it now.
The OTB Podcast Network. With Green Farm on the go. Snack smart with 100% natural, protein-powered chicken bites.
Friday Night Racing
on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by Horse Racing Ireland. Love every racing moment. Visit hri.ie.
All right, very welcome along to this week's edition of Friday Night Racing, brought to you by Horse Racing Ireland. Love every racing moment. Check out hri.ie, or you can follow the new Twitter account at HRI Racing. The hashtag is Every Racing Moment. And I'm delighted to say our guest this week is Jane Mangan. Jane, good afternoon to you. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you, and I'm very pleased to finally have made it in life, that I have made it to Off the Ball.
Ah, here, we would have had you on any time. You're welcome. Look, now that you're here, right, let me just say, I think that you've quickly become one of the best sports pundits on TV in Ireland, in any sport.
Will we just leave it there?
Yeah, okay, time up.
It won't get any better than that.
Johnny, good afternoon to you. I'm right, aren't I?
Yeah, Jane was she's a very talented rider. People shouldn't forget that, actually. She was one of the best amateurs around at the time and seamlessly has made the progress to her media career and obviously the other stuff that she's doing with racing. But that's the end of the platitudes for me. I think we should get down to it now, get gritty.
Well, no, because I want to actually ask you about your punditry, because the racing panel had been very well established over a long period of time. You have those kind of legends and you're injected into it. How did you deal with that? And also, what's your style? Who did you base yourself on?
There's no style. There's just honesty, to be honest. I started, I suppose, in Galway and standing between Ted and Robert. And you can imagine yourself, put yourself in that position, having watched them your entire life. It was a huge, like, I say privilege. And I know people say the word like it's flippant, but it was. And I thought that was going to be the ultimate learning curve for me as essentially a student, to learn from the two masters who've done it for so long. So there's no particular style. I say what I think and I say what I see. And sometimes it's right, sometimes it's wrong. But if it's coming from, if I believe what I say, I can make my argument and people can decide themselves whether it's valid.
As a matter of interest, did you look at other sports and think, I like a little bit of what this person is bringing to it? Or did you decide consciously not to do that? Because I know sometimes when you start television, people are like, oh, you need to do this, 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 and this, and all of a sudden your brain is melted. And then when you go back to actually just doing what it is that made you good in the first place, that's when the natural communication skills take over.
To be honest, again, I wouldn't have said I did any of that. I started... Robbie Irwin from RTE came to me when I was riding and asked if I wanted to do some radio work when I was riding. So I would naturally be always riding in the bumper at the last race on the card. So I'd meet Robbie in the parade ring. We'd do some work from there. It might be Sunday at the Curra or Leopardstown. And I started radio work. And what I found from listening to, whether it's GAA matches or tennis matches or whatever on the radio, you can't see what's happening. So you need the person who's talking on the radio to paint the picture for you, not just tell you what's happening, paint a graphic in your mind so that you can almost be present in the moment. And when I did that for 2-3 years with Richard Pugh, actually, who was the commentator on the radio at the time. And I felt that if I could ace that, if I could be good at the radio, the television would be easier because you can refer to images and pictures on television that you can't on the radio. So I think that was a good grounding. I thought, yeah, if I was recommending to anybody who wanted to get into punditry, if you can portray a scene in somebody's mind without the benefit of an image, you could be pretty good at it.
The other thing about TV is obviously you, and I totally agree, radio is far more difficult to do well than TV because ultimately the pictures are there and they're going to look after themselves anyway. Well, I would say that. But the actual art of punditry as well it's a bit different from ultimately just saying what you see. And you then also have this crossover to a much broader audience. So it's not just the racing public who you're talking to. You sometimes need to be conscious of the fact that you're having a conversation with people who don't know that much about the sport, but who are sucked in for whatever moment on that day. Do you balance that at any point, or do you worry that's somebody else's responsibility just to make sure? How do you get that right?
Yeah, that's something I've taken from the ITV coverage, actually. Obviously, I started on RTE, which is the national broadcaster, which obviously has an audience with differing degrees of knowledge of the sport. Whereas when I do racing TV work, it's obviously a subscription channel and the person watching probably knows more about the race than I do. So you can be a little bit more technical. So yeah, from the two different channels, I would say I'd be a little bit different in the detail. There's one thing I always go back to when I was younger, and still now, I am a control freak. And we only used to buy one racing post in our house. We still only do. And I wanted to hog the racing post for the entirety of the day while the racing was on. So Saturday and Sunday in our house, it was, you know, after dinner, you'd your work done in the morning, you'd perch up and you'd watch the racing. And I didn't want to give the paper to anyone. So naturally, as soon as the race starts, Dad starts asking, who's riding that? What's that by? Where did that run last time? Who's such and such in the red colours? And if I wanted to watch any part of the race without having to look down to answer his question, I needed to know it. So that is kind of how the knowledge part came about, because I wanted to retain the paper and see the race. So the best thing would be to know the knowledge, anticipate his questions, answer them while I continue to watch the race.
Wow.
And that is something that still happens today. I still hog the paper and I don't want to give it away. So I have to know, because the man is sure naturally going to have questions. And if I don't answer them, he's going to take my paper.
That's a class story.
That's families. We should probably have bought another paper.
If you'd bought a second paper, you'd be like, who knows where you'd be now? You might not have bothered learning all that stuff, which at the time you thought this isn't very useful, but actually in the long run, it makes you expert and able to recall stuff for years to come.
Well, you know, when people, they know jockey's style or they know obviously the colours, it was almost down to tactics. Who's out the back? Like, you should know where horses are usually ridden in a race, and if it's a tactical maneuver that they're ridden differently, then that's significant too. So yeah, myself and Dad would have often debates throughout a race, and if I wanted to keep my eyes on the actual television, that's how it would play out.
Right. Was there a little bit of testing going on for your dad? This is like, in retrospect, did he go, sure, I knew what I was doing the whole way along, or was it just having the crack at the time?
No, he's still asking the questions, and look, he's the adult. He should have bought the extra paper.
That's class. It's like the perfect training school for anybody who wants to go into any aspect of racing, I presume, is that you've got to have to learn your material now and spit it back out at me in the middle of a 10 seconds while also maintaining your own argumentative position and trying to win that argument.
Yeah, there often were arguments, and if... you know, it does get annoying, the questions, but essentially he could just take the paper, and you know, that's the controlling nature in me, and it probably stood to me long term, but I'm sure I'm not dissimilar to most other racing families.
And indeed
other sports.
Isn't that punditry right there, like trying to get all the information in one ear while at the same time disagreeing with everybody, and at the same having the knowledge base, making sure that you've got the work done? I think it's the perfect academy for punditry right there. And also, like, for again, we need to bring in the casual listeners. Who is your dad? Tell us a little bit about his story.
Yeah, my dad Jimmy, and my mom Mary is obviously as knowledgeable as any of us, but she perhaps doesn't bother asking all the questions. Maybe she knows it all. But Dad obviously is a trainer himself, and we've a lot of horses here, mostly pointers and young horses, but he did train a national winner called Monty's Pass. He's still here. He's 28 years old now. He's had grade one winners like Connacht Castle in the past, and Winston Boy won at Tyus Days. You know, our family is obviously where you say, did I watch other sports and take bits and pieces from the pundits of other sports? But we don't have anything else on the television here. We're quite boring. But at least we know we have one thing in our repertoire. It's not a diverse thing. And you say about, you know, your knowledge or your belief in what you're saying. You know, if you're alongside Johnny Ward there and he'll naturally stoke the coals every now and again, at least if you believe your own argument, it might not necessarily be right, but you can have a bit of a debate with Johnny.
Far more important than being right.
To be fair though, like what you're saying there, really, it does shine through when you're on TV. You're kind of like, you do your homework and you can kind of get into a position where you're kind of comfortable with what you're doing and you might become complacent. But like, you obviously, like, you do know your, like, when pedigrees come up and all that, you're very much on top of that, which obviously ties in with the other work that you do. But it's refreshing how seriously you take it, because obviously, like, you like, where do you see your media career? Do you see it as like something that could become much bigger, or is it a part-time thing in conjunction with kind of your racing life?
Well, I've always juggled in my life, whether it was race riding and my education or whether it was all my curricular activities, as you say. I'm open to all opportunities and I would never lightly turn down an opportunity. So if it gets bigger, it's because it will get bigger organically. I haven't pushed anything ever. The radio work came around because somebody gave me an opportunity. Same with the television work, and it's worked from there. I love our sport. I think what's good for our sport benefits everybody in it. And I think to get to do what I do is a massive, massive privilege. So I don't take it lightly. And I know so many people would love to be in my position. So I feel very grateful for it.
Just going back to your riding career, like, that's obviously, I would kind of gotten to know you first from that. You're a pretty stylish rider in bumpers. How long were you riding for, actually, at the end of it all, and why did you stop?
Yeah, I think I rode for 6 years. I started when I was 17, and look, obviously I stopped quite young. People ask David Mullins why he stopped. Like, people presume in this sport, when you have success, that's it, you're in it and you're naturally enjoying it. But I started out with the understanding we had Conor Castle here. He was retiring. We might have one or two seasons out of him in point to points, and that would be, you know, for Jane to have fun and enjoy him and say that she did it. I just happened to be kind of good at it, and I had a bit of success early on. People latched on, my phone started to ring, and all of a sudden, 2 or 3 years later, I was front and center on good horses. But that was never the intention for me. And I don't want to sound boring or ungrateful, but I was always going to go to college. When I was in college, I always knew I was going to get a job after college. And naturally, if you have any commitment, you want to give your job 110%. So when I finished my fourth year in CIT, I went to Ascot for King George Day. There's a lovely ladies race there. And I came home and I knew that was it. Galway was the next week. I didn't want to go to Galway.
Why not? You didn't want to go?
No, I didn't. I didn't. I was never. I really like riding horses, and I had great success doing it. But I didn't have what you need to be the best. And whatever I do, I want to be one of the best at it.
Is that hunger?
I put myself under a lot of pressure when I was riding to be the best, and when I was getting to my fourth year of college, I can't describe to you how difficult it was. The balancing act, and I just couldn't maintain it.
So, and this is kind of all hindsight now, you were an amateur rider, but certainly you would have achieved a hell of a lot more than Rachel Blackmore as an amateur rider. Rachel was basically going nowhere when she turned pro, and she'd done okay, but people thought she was mad going pro. So do you look back at all and reflect on, maybe I could have been that Rachel Blackmore? Was it never going to be that jockey career that Rachel has had for you?
I could have never been Rachel Blackmore, because I had never had the grow or the hunger or the will that she has. I would have never taken the falls that she has taken. I would never have been as brave as she is. So I have no regrets. I'm probably describing it wrong. Essentially, I rode, and when I was in it, I wanted to do every horse as much justice as I could. Happy in the knowledge that I wouldn't be doing it for 10 years. Mm. You can give and immerse yourself into something that you know is going to be short term. If you think you're going to be doing it for 30 years, you're almost going to say, take a pull, you know, there we're in this for the long road. But I remember going to college, riding out maybe one lot in the morning, going to college, and then driving 5 hours to Downpatrick, which is from college, 5 hours. 5 hours home, and then the next day doing, like, repeating. And I mightn't have even got one lot in that morning if I didn't get up too early, or if I... It was mind messing with your head as well, knowing that people who are working full time in racing, whether it be your arch rivals Nina Carby or Patrick Mullins, who you aspire to be as good as, were riding 5 and 6, 7 pieces of work every day, and there you were sitting in lecture hall.
Yeah, because you're like looking at back at your figures here. You'd one winner from one ride. Your first year, then you had six. Your stats for the next 3 years were 16%, 12%, 16%, which is really incredible going. So I guess you were at your zenith in maybe 2013, 2014, and I presume it was around then that you started college, was it?
No, I was in college at 2012. I would say my 5 pound claim, I was at my best because I was riding the best horses. The other side to it is, in Ireland, if you're riding predominantly bumpers, Gordon Elliott and Willie Mullins and Noel Mead win 90% of them. Mm. So it's bloody hard to compete then, isn't it?
What were you doing in college?
I did marketing. So I loved business in school, but I was, and I still am, atrocious at numbers. So I wanted to study something in business, and it was marketing. So... I would say it gave me time to mature. I came out of college a completely different person than when I went in.
Is that something that racing people miss out on? Because most people in racing do not go to college.
Perhaps, but racing is an education in itself. Mm. I'd say when I started race riding, I would have been very naive to the real world, and both the reality of racing, the ups and downs that brings you is quite an education as well. But you need to be equipped to take the disappointments, and you need to be equipped to take the highs with the lows. And it's really hard to put into words, but sport does that to you. And you know, in a really competitive person, yes, they always want to win. It's how they take a loss is a real measure of a person. And we say that, but we know people who can't do it. And we know some people, it affects them in their next match or their next ride, and that shouldn't happen.
Could you take a loss?
Yeah, I could. I had my dad, though. Jeez, he was a tough critic. Actually, yeah. I remember one day, my first ride around Tamore on a mare of our own, owned by my mum. She led it up. My dad trained it. And my dad said, look, it's Tamore, it's a very tight track, big field. Just go around the outside and enjoy yourself and get her to come home strong. So I did that, and I came in, and Mam turned to me. She collected the mare, and she said, "Should we may as well have stayed at home? You were basically out in the car park." And that was the criticism and it's a blessing. Like, a lot of people don't have that. But people ask, you know, you were good from an early stage. I'd say my mother wouldn't have left me outside the door if I wasn't going to do some kind of respect.
So just hang on, in case anybody's listening now and are like, you were saying that's actually a good thing, just to make sure that having that.
Well, you can imagine if my mom was thinking it, what everybody else is thinking. Yeah. So you couldn't let that.
But did you not just follow your dad's instructions? Were you not like, I did what dad told me?
Oh, I know, but the mare was running in Mam's colours.
Right. So you listened to the wrong parents, the wrong instructions. That's a good lesson.
Yeah.
Ignore the trainer, listen to what the owner says.
It's very hard to please both, but they both helped me a lot. I do remember my first ride in Mallow, where she was a 33-1 shot. She wasn't expected to win, and they let me do my own thing. So the track in Mallow back then used to be, in 2011, watered by a slurry tank. And the ground in April of that year was flint, absolutely rock hard. They watered one width of a slurry tank. So on the inside, there was a strip of ground that was rock hard. And on the very outside, you could go outside the slurry tank and come up a road, essentially. So I went around the inside and just the bottom of the home straight, I completely went under the standside rail and she just took off. And nobody would have given me that instructions on my first ride. But I kind of had this self-belief in myself. There was no pressure. So I said I'd try it. And it worked.
What was the name of that horse?
Jamie's Darling.
So that was your first ride and your first winner?
Yeah, but I had ridden Connor Castle in a few point of points at that stage, so I'd kind of got my marbles.
So how addictive is the feeling of taking this wild route that no one has thought to take, smarting out the different way that the slurry tank has had the impact on the ground and winning that race? How addictive is the feeling as you cross the finish line?
Well, there's no feeling like your first winner. And I remember walking out the gate that day, Kevin Power, who had finished second, turned to me. He said, enjoy, because it'll never happen again. And I was looking at him being like, does that man think I'm never going to ride another winner? And he realized what he'd said. Look, the winning feeling is special. But when you win on a horse that isn't the best horse in the race, that's very good. And I think that was the case there.
Obviously not so addictive that at some point you're like, okay, that part of my life is over. That's really interesting that, like, you know... you were able to compartmentalize those things.
Yeah, when I stopped in, what was it, 2015, I wasn't having my best season anyway. I was kind of subconsciously winding down. I wasn't taking the 66-1 shot in Downpatrick anymore, which I would have always taken. And I was just putting things in place. So for the last 12 months of me riding, I was putting things in place.
So you knew that you were on the way out at that stage and you had the plan in place. And that's much easier to understand, I think, for people kind of. You did your time, you had that experience, you knew what that was going to be like for everybody. And you can now talk about this for the rest of your life from a position of strength where you've experienced what the weigh room is like, what it's like to win a race, what it's like to lose a race, what it's like to win on horses that weren't the best in the field, what it's like to lose on horses that were the best in the field.
Yes, well, people come to me a lot and they want to break into racing, they want to break into media, and they want to know my story. And ultimately, if I hadn't race ridden, Robbie Irwin wouldn't have known my name and he wouldn't have offered me the radio gig, and it wouldn't maybe have evolved into what it has. So I'm very grateful for it in that respect. But look, everybody's different, and I don't harp on about my own story, but when you're in racing, if you're a jockey, you can't tell anyone that you're going to stop when you finish college, because instantly in their minds, you're not taking it seriously. Mm-hmm. I was giving it everything I could when I was in it, because I didn't want to do any horse an injustice. I see the work that goes into horses every day here at home. I see the owners that buy them and pay for them, and the least they can do is have the person on board give it 100%. So why would I continue on when I couldn't give it everything?
Take us back to Monty's Pass, will you? What age are you in 2003?
Nine. Yeah, it was a special time. I saw it through a different lens than everybody else. I didn't know about the Grand National. Really, I wouldn't have known the significance of it. I remember my parents being a bit nervous pre the National on the build-up that Barry wouldn't ride him. He had the option of riding You'll Never Walk Alone. Thankfully, he stayed loyal to Monty, I think, primarily because he had the track form. He'd been second in the Beecher Chase the year before. I watched it with my grandparents. The things a nine-year-old sees, I noticed my parents getting, I don't know, very animated, and they're not animated kind of people. But when it was all over, I just went outside and I kicked the ball. But it just so happened that I lived at my grandparents for the next 12 months because my parents were so busy off doing other things. And I do have other siblings. I have twin brothers, but they have each other. They're 3 years on me. So I was given to my grandparents for the best part of 12 months while my parents basically lived their dream.
Right. So, did you miss out on the parties in that way? Or what's your recollection of that period of time? Because it's such an amazing foundational experience to live through.
It is. I remember the homecoming. I didn't want to be at the parties. Sure, none of my friends are going to be at the parties. What would it be to me to be around a bunch of, you know, it just wouldn't have been my scene anyway. It wouldn't be probably my scene today, to be honest. I remember the yard getting really busy, and there was a lot of hype after it, but ultimately it passes, things settle down again, and we find our feet. And when you look back at it and how hard it must have been to achieve, you're grateful for the fact that Monty's Pat had a heart murmur, that he couldn't be sold out of the yard because nobody would buy him with that condition, and the fact that it never, ever once got in his way. Those kind of things are what makes racing endearing. And I know we'll go to Cheltenham next month and we'll talk about the big money horses and the big prizes and the big conglomerates of trainers, but there's always one, and he was our one.
I think
there was a relationship between your dad and the owner as well. I remember I've probably mentioned him before. I think I might have mentioned him when Barry Geraghty was on, but I was in college in DCU at the time, and the local bingo hall in Whitehall, I remember the owner of the horse, Mike Futter, from what I recall, he had a bit of a franchise of bingo halls, and apparently all the old ladies and not so old ladies in Whitehall that play bingo were all on Monty's Pass, and the Boyle Sports in Whitehall was cleaned out that day, apparently.
Yeah, I do. I think everybody locally had their money on him, and not just some money. Dad was like, I don't know how you could be so confident in a national. He went from 66s to 16s or whatever he went off. Mike and the rest of the D Racing Syndicate had a small number of horses, and between those few horses, they had what odds with Tucker Geraghty, and they had Monty's Pass it up. Mm. So they had a lot of luck. And Mike obviously made seven-figure sums on the transaction, but the I can imagine the feeling of your horse winning the national is pretty priceless too.
And you're looking at like Amberley House, Monty Foe, Binderee. They were the days, yeah. Won by 12 lengths, and the first four home were all either 10 or 11, which is it was a different race back then, Jane, as well, I guess.
Yeah, he was a very accurate jumper. He made the front page of the Racing Post one day because he fell over hurdles on his preparation for the next national, because he came up outside the wings and clipped the top bar. But he went back the next year as an 11-year-old with top weight, and having won on Good to Firm nearly the year before, it was good ground anyway, he finished fourth on what would be unfavourable ground for him, soft. He had won the Kerry National on firm. Not Good to Firm, firm. Something that wouldn't be allowed in a going description today. Mm. So that you can imagine how firm and sound his legs were. He has a little bit of arthritis in his knees today, but you'd never really tell that he ran so many times on such quick ground. And I thought the training performance from my parents to get him back after the year that they had the year before, having won it as an 11-year-old off top weight, to get him to finish fourth was pretty special, I thought, in their own right. And obviously Amberley House won that year.
And just looking at that there now, the 2002, I'd never seen a jumps race recorded on firm ground before. There you are, the Kerry National 2002 firm. Monty's Pass beats Put Something By a native performance.
Yeah, that wouldn't, he wouldn't get his preferred ground these days, to be perfectly honest. Particularly at Aintree, where they're so afraid of everything welfare that they water it to within an inch of its life.
With the slurry spreader. Go on, Johnny, last point then, Matt. Go on.
There's no slurry tanks watering tracks anymore, by the way.
I remember seeing them well at racetracks, actually. Just to talk about Oscar Delta as well, because as much as it's obviously a sore point, I always admired the way you came out of that, because I think public had a lot of sympathy for you. People may not, not everyone listening in would remember what happened, but this was one of the most unfortunate things I think you've ever seen at Cheltenham. We're going back, it's 8 years now, March 2013, when Salsify, obviously, I think loads of people had Salsify backed in the Fox Hunter that day, but he wouldn't have won if Oscar Delta, to my mind, hadn't been kind of inconvenienced by basically the way the course was laid out. But how do you reflect on it now, all these years later?
The first thing I remember thinking from it, people didn't really know what to say to me. I remember people just hugging me because they didn't have the words. And what could you say? It was an opportunity all the same. you know, I had been on the biggest stage on the best horse in the day, and it hadn't happened for whatever you want to decide the reason. I thought up until then I had given him the near perfect plan A ride. That was our plan. And 2 or 3 weeks later, the next punch of sound, 2 weeks later, I had ridden a very good winner at Berry House, probably got the ride because of Cheltenham. And then a couple of weeks after that was Punchestown, and I rode a winner of the champion bumper for David Pipe, who probably wouldn't have known my name if I hadn't ridden at Cheltenham. So there were things to take from it, and the media, do you know what, the media coverage was serious, and I've always been raised to take every phone call. You know, they're only trying to make a living, and you know, just do what you're supposed to do. But if I was saw somebody in that position now, I would tell them to take stock and give yourself a week or two, because I couldn't even describe it. I couldn't even do it justice until I had absorbed what had actually happened myself. And I remember on the day going into the weigh room, I was on my own. Nina and Katie weren't riding that day, and I had the ladies' changing room to myself. And I got a knock on the door to come back out, because certain TV interviewer wanted to interview me. And I was like a dazzled rabbit in headlights. So if I had any advice for anybody who is in, if God forbid you're ever in a similar situation, it is okay to say no for at least a week.
Does your heart sink when you get asked about it now?
No, it happens, you know, it is what it is. And I love Cheltenham. I went back there last year in a completely different capacity, and I loved doing the coverage of it last year. We went back, myself and Oscar Delta, the next year. We tried to win it. It didn't happen. And you can't leave these things make you bitter or get you down. It happened. You move on. And like I said at the start of the program, if you're in sport, you need to be able to take the ups with the downs. And fortunately, after that, we were able to build on it.
Does that inform your punditry? I mean, it has to in some ways, where somebody gives a bad ride or makes a mistake, you're not going to kill them because you know what it's like to be on the other side of that.
Yeah, well, it's not that long ago it happened Michael O'Sullivan at the November meeting at Cheltenham, the same thing, the horse went through the rail. You can blame people, you can blame the track configuration, you can blame yourself, you can blame the horse. Ultimately, none of it makes a difference.
If you remember, Charles,
make sure it doesn't happen again.
It was this kind of, it was about 150 yards out, and he'd jumped the last, and like Salsify wasn't making any ground, as much as he was a big price or whatever, he was definitely the best horse in the day. But there was this kind of I don't know what you'd call it, James, fairly flimsy sort of a tape that basically stopped the horse from going out in another circuit. But the horse obviously had it in his head that he was basically going to do the circuit that he'd done previously. So he just treated the tape as you would, like, you know, something that basically wouldn't bother you at all.
Oh, there you go. The old line of Johnny is gone. Look, let's move on, Jane, because I wanted to ask you a favour first. Maybe you'd do a small bit of punditry for us, would you?
Oh, we'll try our best.
I'm going to show people this, right? So this is Young Dev, and it's Hugh Morgan's ride at Navan last Sunday. If we could roll it there, Roisin. So he's lost his stirrups very, very early on in the race. And this is the racing again, March 6th handicap chase for Dennis Hogan. Let's have a look.
Young Dev's rider Hugh Morgan is without the help of his Ardens as they jump the next fence in the back straight, number 3, Young Dev. Fenice Shay Malerk from Dubai Devils, and in between them is Young Dev as they come to the final fence in this 3 mile handicap. And the grey Young Dev over on the far side has come to pick it up from Shay Malerk. In third place is Dubai Devils, and up the hill towards the finish it is Young Dev on the far side and Hugh Morgan for a remarkable win. This is extraordinary, Young Dev from Shay Malerk.
It is extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah, it was a joy to watch. I was thinking he'd definitely pull up after I'd seen what had happened. I can only fathom. So once or twice here, if a horse had a sore wither, you'd try and exercise him without a saddle. So you'd either lunge him, or if he was really quiet, ride him with no saddle. And like I did that. I had barely any control, could barely walk the next day. So he did it on over 3 miles over fences on soft ground at Navan. It was extreme horsemanship. Number one, you'd admire that he never looked like he was losing his balance. At no stage was he hanging back over a fence or was he landing out on all fours. He was always in balance. He was always in control of the horse. I'd imagine the horse is probably a very good ride because you'd have very little control pulling a horse if you had no irons. And then when it came to the business end of the race, the horses had to be very willing. But at the same time, Hugh never inconvenienced the horse. He was never out of a rhythm. So you can tell that young man obviously has ridden horses full length in show jumping saddles because he's got a great natural balance about him and a core strength. Like, you can have balance, but his fitness must be out of this world. His core strength to keep him centered, to keep him exactly where he should be and not interfering with the horse's stride at any stage. I thought it was just a joy to watch. And an example, if you think you can ride with stirrups, you know, not many people can ride without them.
The quality of people we have who are working in horse racing and who are riding, like, so Hugh's not famous, right? He's not one of our more famous jockeys who we would speak about all the time. But here, randomly at Navan last Sunday, he produces this thing which is truly exceptional.
Absolutely. But he also not only has the talent, but he had the will. A lot of people, including myself, would have pulled up after a fence. The fact that he said, I'm going to try and win this. I'm going to try and stay competitive in this, even though this circumstance has happened. That's pretty special. Like, we talked about James Bowen yesterday in the bumper for Nicky Henderson, but he couldn't pull up even if he wanted to. You know, Hugh had the option, and that was a decision I'd say very few riders would have taken. And you say he's not a star, but he's still 5 pound claimer. He might be a star in the making.
Well, that's the thing. A performance like that kind of does mark you out as somebody. I suspect his phone has been busy over the course of the last week as well.
Yeah, look, it's a unique ride. It's something that will project his name. But as I would say to anybody who was in his position, or indeed a position of prominence, you have to take the opportunity. You have to take the advantage while you can, because next week it'll be James Bowen, or next week it'll be somebody else. So I know it'll be considered, and it probably should definitely win Ride of the Year. But Hugh Morgan, strike while the iron is hot. There are rides to be got at Cheltenham.
So you're going to have another sideline as a jockey's agent, is that what I'm hearing as well?
No, I have the utmost admiration for jockey's agents. God almighty, dealing with trainers must be a desperate, desperate occupation.
It's funny how so few of the kids of trainers, with some obvious exceptions, automatically go, yeah, I'm definitely going to be a trainer. What's your long-term plan in the racing game? Would you have ever any interest in taking out your trainer's license?
Another thing, I don't tend to think too far ahead. I'm so lucky to be doing what I'm doing right now. I would have never contemplated training, and I don't think I ever will. I think I'll always have mares to breed from and have, you know, hopefully runners in a breeder's capacity. But no, training, I think for all of our family, I don't think my brothers have any interest. They can come on here and tell me otherwise if they want, but it doesn't look likely at the moment. And yeah, I'd say we're happy with what we're doing.
Very good.
How is the day job going for you?
Yeah, extremely busy at the moment, Johnny. This time of year for me is manic. The covering season, the breeding season is well underway. Foals are arriving, and then the racing is so good as well. And it's so hard to try and keep up with all of it. But this time of year, I'd always look forward to seeing the four-year-olds running and to see the first season sires, how they cope. Just unfortunately, with the lack of four-year-old point of points, etc., it's a little bit different in 2021.
The nature of the job, like, you're working for a massive, massive operation, but is it like, you know, is it enjoyable, I suppose?
Most enjoyable. I wouldn't do anything if I didn't get satisfaction and enjoyability out of it. I like to go to the races and see why the end product is what it is. Why did that mare go to that stallion? I've often gone on Racing TV and said, well, the mare won over 2 miles and he's by a 5 furlong stallion. To me, this horse could be triplets. You know, it's nice to go on and be able to say he's out of a miler by a 6 furlong, 7 furlong horse. And you can almost try and make a prediction before they run. But if you're scratching your head pre-race, often the case you're scratching your head post-race.
I think actually it's one thing that I find with the lads that would back horse, I think it's one thing they totally neglect. And you're like, they don't really know the pedigrees of horses as well as they should. Or like, you know, you see the likes of Fran Berry now when he's on Racing TV, like he's always on top, but there are certain stallions he'll be cold on, certain he'll be hot on himself. Kevin O'Ryan will say, well, they'll likely handle the ground better or whatever. And you'll have a great knowledge of it as well. It's your actual role is like, is it a bloodstock consultant for Coolmore? Is that right?
I deal with the pedigrees, so whatever it entails and any of the questions that come along with it. But I suppose it is Fran's job, it is Kevin's job, and it is my job to try and make it easier for the punter at home. And any information that like that that comes our way that we think might be pertinent to an argument or to indeed a stake should be given across. And like, even in the National Hunt sphere, we all know that horses excel on heavy ground. It's the same with trainers. We all know that Venetia Williams' horses thrive on heavy ground. There's a reason for that. It's either the conditions they're galloping on at home, or, you know, I find it fascinating. And obviously, there's exceptions to every rule. Tiger Roll shouldn't be winning Grand Nationals. But at the same time, that, you know, if breeding was a simple game, everybody'd be doing it and I'd be out of a job.
The science and the art, the mix of science and art in that part of the game, I think those are unbelievable stories, and they really are fascinating to see how people put these collections of horses together, and over a period of time they develop. Like, what drew you to that part of the game as a matter of interest? Because, you know, given your background, you literally had the choice of almost any of the various roles. What was it specifically that brought you that direction?
Yeah, that was a natural progression as well. I again, up with my grandparents when I was in November or December, whenever Mam and Dad would be selling their foals. That's our harvest every year. And I'd ring on the old, you know, home phone with the cordless, you know, the corded home phone. And I'd have my pen in my hand and I'd be writing down what each foal made that day. And Dad might, like, it was pounds at the time, and Dad would say, well, that horse, that foal made 800 pounds, and then that made 5,000 pounds. And I'd be like, Dad, why did that make 800 pounds? And he'd tell me, oh, well, the stallion wasn't very popular, or the mare is a little bit, whatever, a little bit older, the pedigree isn't good enough. And my first question, like, as a child, like, children are so decisive. And I know it's naive and innocent, but at the same time, there was a truth to it. I'd say, why did you go to that stallion? Why are you breeding from that mare? You know, it just didn't make sense to a 5, 6, 7 year old child. And I kind of carried it through, and we're still doing it. We're still making the same mistakes, but hopefully we're making them less often. And that's kind of how it started. And it's a big thing in our family, breeding. Pedigrees is a big conversation. And if it's not a new sensation that, say, French breds excel in Ireland and in England. I think Fortina won a Gold Cup. Wasn't he French? There's so much to learn, and there's always an alternative argument. And both arguments can be valid, but at the same time, sure, don't you have a good conversation while you're trying to bat it out?
And not only that, then, the arguments can both be valid, but you get to prove them one way or another eventually in the racing. So that kind of whole hierarchy where all of these things are connected and everything is everything, I think that's the bit, I don't know if that's the art as opposed to the science, where you can have that long-running conversation that lasts many years, and then maybe it finally gets to play out in a race sometime.
Yeah, it gives me a lot of satisfaction when you get one line, and there's a lot of homework goes into it, and there's a lot of research. But when I was in Cheltenham last year and Champ caught Alaho and Manila Indo on the line in the RSA, and I could come out and say, well, his mother's a sister to Best Mate. and he knew where the line was at Cheltenham. Isn't that nice? And I know it doesn't always work out, and I'm sure Bestmate has other sisters that bred something that was no good, but it only takes one. And for breeding purposes, the percentage of getting a good horse is obviously quite unlikely, but you can try and hedge your bets by getting all the variables on point.
It's like the striker who makes the same run 100 times and scores, and 101st time he makes the run. It's doing all that homework and having that line ready to go. That's the value of the research, and it takes us nicely back to sitting with the Racing Post and making sure that you get to hog it. Jane, honestly, it's been brilliant having you on the show. I think that's one of the nicest stories I've ever heard. And honestly, there's a standing offer for you to come on anytime on Off the Ball. Thanks a million for joining us.
I appreciate that, guys. Have a great show.
Thanks, Jane. You too.
It's Jane Mangan there giving us some insight into... that's just the whole area of the business that's unbelievably fascinating to me, Johnny. There's definitely some science. There's a lot of art in the breeding industry.
Yeah, TG Carr's had a lovely series that Dave Keane and Dennis Kerwin and a few others have been involved in. And last night it kind of looked at... I guess just some of the heroes of the sport that came from Ireland in the jumps game. And I thought the one, I don't know about Monksfield, like, I thought it was like borderline moving, really, if not just moving, because, you know, Desi McDonough, who really only have a handful of horses kind of all his career, obviously Declan's dad or whatever, he told the story of how he came across Monksfield at a sale, and he just gave him this kind of look, like he was kind of as if to say, Monksfield was kind of telling Desi was with some fella, and Monksfield looked at the two of them and he said, like, why are you bothering me here? I'm trying to sleep. And he said, for some reason, they had this connection. He felt this connection with the horse. I don't know what his pedigree was like, whether he probably wasn't overly expensive. But then towards the end, anyways, they showed, like, Monksfield was this unbelievably gutsy horse. He had a brilliant attitude. If you're around today, people would love him. And at the end, then Desi said, you know, we really had this connection. I felt it, and I really hope he felt it too. And it was just lovely to watch. And then that's one side of it. And then the other side is like people who pore over pedigrees. And I think what's really intriguing about where Jane's game, the game of pedigrees, is that racing is such a fashionable thing. So if a first season stallion is cold, nobody wants to know about him. And Galileo, you remember, like, his fee was reduced from 50 grand to 37.5 early on because he wasn't doing that well. So a lot of people got that wrong. And that's why I think there's one thing about pedigrees, but some people look at a horse and they just see something that maybe someone else doesn't. And probably that's what Jimmy saw when his 5-year-old daughter saying to him, why are you putting money in these dud stallions? Because he obviously saw something that he liked.
Yeah, that would be a good conversation to eavesdrop on sometime as well. Friday Night Racing brought to you by Horse Racing Ireland. We're still in the phony war before Cheltenham actually kicks off proper in the Tote 10 to Follow competition, as I'm still 28 points ahead of you. This is obviously a very slender lead, though. There are 7 bonus point races on the card at the festival, so that will give you plenty of opportunity to make a comeback. Check out tote.ie to avail of the Tote price guarantee at this year's Cheltenham Festival. The lead that I have is 333 versus 305. So it's I'm not going to start bragging just yet, Johnny. I'm not counting any of my my horses just yet, or my foals before they... No foal, no fee.
I think your odds on, to be fair. Should be mentioned as well, a little story that emerged from the week. Charles Burns is obviously, he's gotten a 6-month ban, but he recently called a horse No Deterrent, and irishracing.com tried to get a story out from a comment, but he said he wasn't commenting. But it would suggest that Charles is already planning his comeback, calling a horse No Deterrent. And when you go down then towards the end of the story, he called a horse It's Not Coming Home the day after England were knocked out of the 2018 World Cup. So can't say the man doesn't have a sense of humour.
The problem is that it may well come home after the Euros, which are more than likely going to end up in England, and their team is absolutely sensational. What's on this weekend? What are we looking forward to?
Yeah, tomorrow is brilliant racing. Without kind of downplaying the Irish Straw Fairyhouse Good card, I think Kempton is really good tomorrow with the Adonis Hurdle and some Grade Ones. And really unfortunate, Goran. Goran has had an awful bad run of it in terms of bad weather. Meeting's been called off. Obviously, the pandemic and all that, but they've lost their Red Mills meeting. And a couple of races moved to Fairyhouse tomorrow, which is a very good card. And then Sunday, we return to Naas. And then we're basically counting down to Cheltenham, which is just over 2 weeks away now.
All right, good stuff, Johnny. Thanks a million for that.
Thanks, sir.
Friday Night Racing brought to you every Friday afternoon at 3 o'clock on all of Off the Ball's social channels. And then, of course, it also broadcasts at 8 o'clock on Friday night on Off the Ball on News Talk. And it's brought to you by Horse Racing Ireland. Love every racing moment. Check out hri.ie. See you next
Friday
week.
Friday Night Racing
on Off the Ball.
And they're off.
Brought to you by Horse Racing Ireland. Love every racing moment. Visit hri.ie.
The OTB Podcast Network, with Green Farm on the go. Snack smart with 100% natural, protein-powered chicken bites.